You're listening to Life, the Universe, and Everything Else. Today on the show, caffeine. Specifically, coffee and tea.
Life, the Universe, and Everything Else is a program promoting secular humanism and scientific skepticism that is produced by the Winnipeg Skeptics and the Humanists, Atheists, and Agnostics of Manitoba. You can email your questions, comments, or criticisms to us at lueepodcast@winnipegskeptics.com. Show notes, references, and relevant links for all episodes can be found at lueepodcast.wordpress.com or at winnipegskeptics.com/blog.
My name is Jem Newman, and with me today I have Laura Creek Newman.
Hi there.
And Ian James, formerly Leung.
Hey.
So today we're talking about everybody's favorite caffeinated beverages. We're going to start off talking about coffee and about caffeine more generally, and then we'll move on to discuss tea. And we'll finish off by comparing the caffeine content of various beverages and food items. But first, we're going to talk about a tea-related news item. So did you guys hear about this? These pesticide traces that have been found in teas in Canada?
No, Jim.
Yes.
I haven't. Please enlighten.
Laura, you read this this news item?
Yeah, I didn't actually read it, but I read the headline many times. That counts,
oh,
right?
Oh, good. Well, that's almost as good. So I'll give you guys the lowdown. CBC Marketplace, which is an investigative reporting show, basically took a bunch of teas that are sold in Canada to some independent labs and had them tested for pesticide traces. And the headline is, pesticide traces in some tea exceed allowable limits. So I'll quote from the article that was posted to the CBC website. Quote, using an accredited lab, CBC used the testing method employed by the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, that's CFIA, to test pesticide residues in dry tea leaves. Half of the teas tested contained pesticide residues above the allowable limits in Canada, and 8 of the 10 brands tested contained multiple chemicals, with one brand containing residues from 22 different pesticides. Skipping ahead in the article, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency declined to speak with the CBC in an interview, but in a statement, the agency says that while many teas failed to meet levels set by the government, the agency sees no cause for alarm, even for teas that exceed limits. Health Canada says that a person would have to consume approximately 75 cups of tea per day over their entire lifetime to elicit an adverse health effect, according to a spokesperson from the CFIA. Now, this is very true. As we discussed in our two-part episode on organic agriculture, the safety limits set by regulatory bodies are typically several orders of magnitude lower than the known harmful dose of a pesticide. So that is to say, a producer could spray 10 times as much pesticide on their crop as Health Canada allows, and there would be no ill effects for a person consuming a normal amount of the product. So it's true that this probably isn't a cause for concern for the consumer, but the question remains, with the safety limits set as they are, why is CFIA not enforcing their own guidelines?
That's a hell of a good question, Jem.
Mm-hmm.
I do not know the answer.
I'm curious as to why, if it's easily determined that these teas are exceeding the allowable limits for pesticides, I'm simply curious as to why CFIA, if they're aware of it, why they haven't told these producers to shape up. And if they're not aware of it, why? Why wouldn't they be aware of it? Because food inspection is sort of their job.
Right. My guess is that it's a significant lack of resources and manpower to do anything about it.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those things, if you just don't go looking for a problem, then you won't have to fix anything.
Yeah, until somebody dies of tea poisoning, I don't think anything will change.
Mm-hmm.
So in the article, they quote an expert, if you like drinking tea, you can drink organic tea, which is less likely to be contaminated by pesticides. But even then, CFIA testing has found the presence of pesticide residues on organic tea leaves, end quote. Now, this is, of course, given what we know about organic agriculture, this shouldn't be surprising.
Nope.
The listener can listen to our episodes on the subject for more on organic pesticides.
I think we had this conversation on that episode. anything and everything is to a degree unsafe, I think. You know, I don't think anything that you eat or drink or, you know, wash your clothes with or whatever is 100% unharmful. I don't know if that's the right word, but...
Yeah,
sure. Well, the poison's always in the dose.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll tell a brief story about the town that I grew up in Saskatchewan, where we used well water. And we used well water for, I mean, my entire life until I moved away. And then I found out a couple years ago that they weren't able to use the well water anymore. And my parents had to use bottled water and they had to buy water from the store and blah, blah, blah. Because it turns out that the well water was below the regulation, meaning that, you know, obviously you can only dig a well so deep. And if your well is deeper than that, it's unsafe. But it wasn't the well that was the problem. They had changed the regulation. So they said, up until this point, this level was acceptable, but now we've changed what level is acceptable. So your well didn't change, but our regulations did. So now your well, which you've been using for however many years, is now unsafe because we changed our regulation.
Should that not have been grandfathered in?
This is Saskatchewan.
On the one hand, like, I can see how that's annoying, but on the other hand, you know, if the evidence available to them does change and they find that, oh, it turns out that we are seeing long-term health effects in people with these specific types of wells, which used to be common, then, you know, I can see why they would tell people that they have to change their water setup. But I can definitely see how that would be frustrating.
I likes my well the way I always likes my well. Ain't nobody gonna tell me I can't drink from my well.
Sorry.
So why don't we start talking about coffee? So I know you two both drink coffee, Ian. How do you like your coffee?
I usually like a 2 cream and 1 sugar if I'm going to the coffee house. I just really enjoy it. I will get a cup of coffee going, and if I have the good cream in the house, I'll load it up with the good cream. And
oh yeah.
If the coffee's good, I don't need sugar. Cream is fine. Like when I go to your place and have coffee, I will often not have sugar because it's just really good with just the cream. And yeah, I'll sit on the couch under a blanket and, you know, play video games or whatever and just...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, sitting at my desk and checking my emails or blah, blah, blah. It's so much more enjoyable with a cup of coffee. It's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. I'm with that as well. I drink coffee because I like it. Although, if I don't drink it, I don't find that I crave it, but I'll say... Oh man, it's 11 o'clock. Why am I so tired? Why is my head pounding? Oh, I haven't had any coffee yet.
There you go. Yeah, it's true. It's horrifying. I didn't start drinking coffee really heavily until I moved to Winnipeg, where I grew up anyway. We didn't really have like fast, quick, convenient coffee places where you could just stop in, get a coffee and leave. That sort of thing isn't where I grew up anyway. It was you go for coffee. So you go to the restaurant. They pour you the coffee. You know what I'm saying? It's an event more than just, I need my coffee and I got to go somewhere else. With 100% honesty, I didn't start drinking coffee in earnest until the roll up the rim to win. which, I don't know if, is that, do most people know what that is? I mean, obviously Canadian listeners will know, but.
For our American listeners, the biggest.
Chain?
Coffee chain.
The biggest chain of coffee houses in Canada is called Tim Hortons.
Jim, coffee house is very generous. Please do not call it that. Restaurants that serve coffee.
Yeah. It's the Canadian Dunkin' Donuts equivalent. Anyway, it's called Tim Hortons, and every sort of February, March, there's a what they call Roll Up the Rim to Win, which is a contest. You know, you have a chance of winning a car and winning, you know, food prizes, more coffees, etc. And the way you play is by, after you finish your coffee, you basically roll up the rim of the coffee cup where the lid fits on, and it'll usually say, please play again.
Yeah, I got a cup of coffee and I won another cup of coffee, and so I went back, of course, and got another cup of coffee. And then won again on that cup of coffee. So it was like 3 in a row. And literally that was the jumping point. And I now...
That's how the addiction started.
It really was. And I mean, you know, Tim Hortons, you know, they got me. So now for the most part, if I don't make it at home, which my wife will be dismayed to know that I don't make it at home that often, I get it almost every day.
How about you, Laura?
Yeah, I'm a coffee every day kind of person. I really enjoy it, and the caffeine has a hold on me. I'm very similar to Ian in that I didn't really start drinking coffee until a little bit later. Actually, it was your influence, Jem, that
yeah, sorry about that.
Got me drinking coffee, but probably a good thing because then I got onto coffee and off of all the hot chocolates and French vanillas and that, so I had a calorie savings there anyways. But I like my coffee at Tim Hortons or any other takeout coffee. I'll get one milk, one sugar, or occasionally a sweetener. When I'm at home, though, because of you, we keep 10% cream in the house. And so I have my coffee with brown sugar and a little bit of 10% cream.
Oh, well done. How about you, Jim?
For my part, I love coffee. I've been a regular coffee drinker since I was 12. I love the taste of it. I love the feel of it in my mouth. I love the smell of freshly ground coffee beans. When I drink coffee, you know, I used to do the double thing, but nowadays usually I just get one cream, maybe two, or more recently I've been having it black. Initially, my addiction to coffee was purely psychological. It was a habit. It was a comforting morning or even evening ritual for me to have a cup of coffee or three. And it tastes delicious. There also seems to be a chemical component now, which I first noticed several years ago when I was in Gimli and couldn't get a good cup of coffee, so I just went without, which was a mistake. So that's when I realized that I was really addicted. And I've been under doctor's orders and dietitian's orders, I should mention, for years to cut down my caffeine intake because it exacerbates my acid reflux. I've cut it down a little bit from its peak of about 2 liters a day to only about a liter, maybe a liter and a half. A liter being a quart, more or less, for our American listeners.
You drink a liter a day?
At least. This morning I had an extra large coffee at Tim Hortons, which is about 710 milliliters.
Oh, God, so... Jim.
Wait, I'm sorry. Those are 700 milliliters?
Yeah.
Yes!
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, they're 24 ounces.
That is impressive, sir.
That's yes. The new extra large size. And then I had two cups of black coffee at work, and I had a large chai tea, and now I'm having another pot of chai tea right now. So recently my caffeine addiction has gotten pretty bad, and I've taken to stuffing my face with handfuls of coffee beans because they're delicious.
Fair enough.
So I would like to bust some myths about caffeine, if you don't mind. So...
Myth number one.
Caffeine is a diuretic. If you drink it, you risk dehydration because it makes you pee. So this is actually something that I believed for quite a long time, and it turns out that it's not true. And I have my friend Derek Cormier pointed this out to me when he looked into it. I'll quote from the results of a 2003 systematic review published in the Journal of Human Nutrition and Dietetics. Quote, "The available literature suggests that acute ingestion of caffeine in large doses results in short-term stimulation of urine output in individuals who have been deprived of caffeine for a period of days or weeks. But a profound tolerance to the diuretic and other effects of caffeine develops, and the actions are much diminished in individuals who regularly consume tea or coffee. Doses of caffeine equivalent to the amount normally found in standard servings of tea, coffee, and carbonated soft drinks appear to have no diuretic action." So what that means is, if you drink coffee or tea regularly, once every day or two, then caffeine effectively has no diuretic effect. So it's not going to dehydrate you at all. It can be a part of your daily hydration. And it's not going to make you go to the bathroom any more often than drinking really anything else.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
So an interesting point on that is that if you do consume coffee or tea, you can actually count that as part of your hydration. A lot of times people are told not to count any coffee or tea that they drink or caffeinated coffee or tea towards their hydration because it's a diuretic. But you can actually count it in how much fluid you're getting in a day. So
really?
Anybody out there who's trying to get fluid in, you know, water is always your best choice. You should always be going with that, but you can count your coffee and tea as well.
If you've been drinking it on a regular basis already.
Yes, yes. If you don't normally drink caffeinated coffee or tea and you down a pot of coffee, well, then it's probably going to have the opposite effect that you're looking for.
Man, you can really learn something from these podcasts, folks. I literally did not know that. I'm glad you said that, Jim, because I believed the exact opposite. I was told that I don't know the exact numbers, but for every cup of coffee you drink, you have to drink 2 cups of water to compensate or whatever.
Well, there's a lot of sort of out of date information that makes its way around, you know, the internet about how much you need to drink. You know, people are always talking about 2 liters of water a day or eight glasses of water a day. You don't really need that. I mean, maybe 2 liters of water a day is great, so long as you take into account all of the liquid that you take in from food as well, you know.
Right.
But you don't need to sit down and down 2 liters of water a day. Although I do, because it's a thing to do while I'm working.
Fair enough.
And Ian, actually, another point on that is that, okay, the more coffee you drink, you'll need to drink more water to make up for it. But really, the more fluid that you drink, the more fluid you're going to expel. So even if you're sitting there drinking water all day, like when I used to study for university, I would sit there and drink water and I'd be up to the bathroom every 20 minutes.
Right.
But because the more water you drink, the more water is going through you. And it's the same thing with coffee. So
yeah, I mean, that seems to make sense to me, right? Like you're mm-hmm. drinking liquid, you need to expel it. I mean, you know, that seems fairly obvious, but I am enlightened.
All right. Let's move on.
Myth number 2.
Caffeine will stunt your growth. Nope. Not true.
Myth number 3.
I'm going to go through these as quickly as possible. Caffeine isn't really that addictive. Now, that's definitely a myth. Caffeine is a psychoactive drug. If you're addicted to caffeine, like I am, you will crave it. Eventually, you'll develop a tolerance for it. If you quit cold turkey, you'll go into withdrawal. But because caffeine addiction doesn't carry the negative social consequences that we usually associate with addiction, caffeine isn't likely to get you fired or ruin your marriage, it's somehow seen as a lesser addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Roland Griffiths, who's a professor at Johns Hopkins, studied the symptoms of caffeine withdrawal in 2005. And unsurprisingly, to anyone who's missed a few cups, he found that the most common symptoms of withdrawal were headache, fatigue, depression, irritability, difficulty concentrating, and even flu-like symptoms. The research indicated that about half of regular caffeine consumers would experience withdrawal if they stopped cold turkey. And according to Dr. Griffiths, regular consumers of caffeine may be more likely to use it to stave off withdrawal symptoms than because they actually want a cup of coffee.
Oh.
Hmm.
Have you ever experienced that, Jim?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
Although it is worth noting that not everybody agrees. The Health Canada website, for example, on their FAQ related to caffeine, says that caffeine is not considered to be an addictive substance. And I quote, "Caffeine consumption does not lead to an inability to stop consuming it. As such, it is not considered to be addictive." To me, that seems to be a rather narrow definition of addiction, but I thought I should mention it for the sake of completeness.
Myth number 4.
Coffee beans are beans. Nope.
Myth number 5.
Jim, give some context. Come on.
I'm getting there.
Myth number 5.
Coffee beans are the seed of a berry. Nope.
Myth number 6.
Coffee beans are the seed of a cherry. Wrong again.
Oh my god, Jim.
Myth number 7.
But it's called the coffee cherry. Surely that makes it a cherry. Well, almost.
Are you kidding me?
The coffee cherry isn't really a cherry.
Oh, God.
Although it is related. The coffee fruit is a drupe, which is a fruit in which the outer flesh surrounds a stone. Other examples of drupes include olives, mangoes, cherries, of course, coconuts, which are totally not a nut, pistachios, which are also not a nut, almonds, which are again not nuts, olives, yes, they're technically a type of fruit, apricots, and peaches. So, the coffee bean is not a bean. It is a seed, but it's the seed of a fruit is classified as a drupe, but it's often called the coffee cherry.
Jim, I think we need to change the intro. You need to introduce yourself as Pedantic Jim today.
On the show today, Pedantic Jim.
I'm Pedantic Jim every day.
Yeah, but...
Myth number 8.
We're getting close to the end of the myths here. Caffeine is prohibited by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Now, many people believe that coffee and tea, along with any other beverages containing caffeine, such as cola, are prohibited by the Mormon Church, as laid out in the Word of Wisdom in the LDS Doctrine and Covenants. And this is actually true, sort of. Although the church has actually been asked directly about this several times, the church takes no official position on caffeine itself. The Word of Wisdom actually prohibits, and I quote, hot drinks. The official church interpretation of this phrase is fairly brief, and I'll quote from their handbook on LDS.org. Quote, the only official interpretation of hot drinks, DNC 89.9, in the Word of Wisdom is the statement made by early church leaders that the term hot drinks means tea and coffee. Members should not use any substance that contains illegal drugs, nor should members use harmful or habit-forming substances except under the care of a competent physician. End quote. So while it's probably not harmful, caffeine may well fall under the category of habit-forming. However, it is not specifically prohibited itself. A brief tangent on the Word of Wisdom. I quote from the Doctrine and Covenants, all grain is good for the food of man, and barley for all useful animals, and for mild drinks, as also other grain. Now you'll note that the use of barley to make mild drinks seems to be endorsed by this passage. And church apostles Brigham Young Jr. and John Henry Smith apparently argued that beer was thus not prohibited by the Doctrine and Covenants. However, the church now teaches that alcohol in any form is prohibited. Strangely, church apostle John A. Widso taught that refined flour was also prohibited by the Doctrine and Covenants, although I couldn't find a reference in the actual Doctrine and Covenants as to why it would be, and the church did not agree with that either. Finally, it's also interesting to note the Doctrine and Covenants also recommends limiting one's consumption of meat. So Atkins-friendly, Mormonism is not. And that rumor that you might have heard that the Mormon Church owns a significant stake of shares in the Coca-Cola Corporation? Much like the Book of Mormon, that's completely made up.
Nice.
Okay, one final myth.
The final myth.
This might seem like a weird question for our American listeners, but does Mountain Dew contain caffeine?
Oh, I know.
Laura?
Sometimes.
Good answer. Bold answer.
Do you want me to elaborate?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, go.
I may not have the most recent answer, but possibly until recently, it did not in Canada, but it did in the United States.
Sure.
Right. Due to some sort of bylaw in Canada that soft drinks containing a certain percentage of juice could not be caffeinated or something to that effect?
It actually has to do with the flavor and color of the beverage.
Yes.
Oh. Until 2010, Health Canada guidelines actually prohibited any soft drinks that were not cola soft drinks from being caffeinated.
Really? Oh, that seems odd.
Now, this is interesting, and Laura, you seem aware that this changed recently. Mountain Dew has been available in Canada since it was acquired by Pepsi-Cola in 1964, but the Canadian formula did not contain caffeine. Now, as I was comparing the caffeine content between beverages, which we'll get to later in the show, I was ready to pedantically include both Canadian and American Mountain Dew as separate entries, with the Canadian Mountain Dew, of course, 0 milligrams of caffeine. However, I have the useful habit of double and triple checking my work, and I discovered that just 2 years ago, in 2012, PepsiCo released a new Mountain Dew recipe in Canada, which now includes caffeine, just like its American counterpart. So take that, fellow pedantic Canadians!
Well, there you go. I like Mountain Dew. I don't know why everybody seems to make fun of Mountain Dew. I like it.
It's pretty much the worst.
Ugh.
No, you know what? I used to like it when I was younger, but now it's too syrupy for me now. Yeah. It's like, I like the flavor, but it's syrupy. Too much. I kind of need to water it down.
Yeah, I guess so.
So, yeah.
I don't drink that much pop anyway, so it's not like I'm, you know, drinking a Mountain Dew as we're recording this, but if it's around, I'll definitely have one.
So those are our caffeine-related myths. We wanted to talk a little bit more about coffee before we move on to talking about tea. Ian, do you want to tell us a little bit about Kopi Luwak?
Kopi Luwak, yes. I do want to tell you about that because it's gross. first and foremost, I had no idea this even existed until I was asked to do a bit of research for this show. So I thank you, Jem, for making this part of my consciousness. I think it's probably best to sum up what it is briefly first, so that going forward, everybody knows what it is. It is a coffee. It is made from coffee beans or seeds, as Jem has already said. So the long and short of it is that in a lot of Asian cultures, the coffee cherry is eaten by an animal. And I'm going to use the Latin term because I know Jem will appreciate it. The Paradoxurus hermaphroditus. Anyway, so it's like a little rodent-type creature called the civet, the Asian palm civet. Anyway, so the Asian palm civet eats these cherries. And of course, it can't digest the seeds, so the seeds pass through the animal, and then they are left in little bundles around, often around plantations. And those seeds that have passed through the digestive system of this animal are then processed into coffee. The idea being that the digestive system of the animal and the health of the animal and so on and so forth will add to or take away certain flavors, like bitterness, for example, but add also sort of a smoothness and other earthly, you know, sort of flavors to the coffee beans. And because it's such a strange and, I guess, rare occurrence, because you have to find the animal's droppings to obtain these beans, it is extremely expensive and a rare treat for the people who get to enjoy it. So there you go. Long and short of it, it's poo coffee.
Yeah, and it you know, for a cup of this coffee, a consumer in North America could pay, you know, $100.
Yes, it was actually, upon more research, it was featured on an episode of Jerry Seinfeld's internet show, Coffee with Comedians. And it was the episode featuring Jay Leno, and they paid $75 for the cup of coffee. Jerry,
which is close to $100 Canadian.
That's true. Actually, that's a good point. Thank you. Jerry finished his. Jay Leno did not, just as a side note. I'm going to do a very, very brief history of how it came to be, because, I mean, I don't know why, but it seems like all the sort of really high-end, really, really fancy pants type foods are always the most disgusting. I mean, caviar, you know, foie gras and all these kinds of things. And what else, Jem, can you think of off the top of your head that seems the most horrible parts of the animal or things you would never think to eat always seem to be the most sort of decadent?
Bird's nest soup is one that comes to mind.
Like, what even is that? Like, that
it's a soup made from a bird's nest, and the nest itself is primarily made up of the bird's saliva.
Right, there you go. So
tasty.
So continuing on with this sort of strange human practice of eating the most disgusting things and charging the most for it. The idea of how this coffee even came to be was, of course, on plantations, on coffee farms and stuff. I believe it started in Indonesia, where the workers were not allowed to actually pick the crop for themselves to make their own coffee. All of the produce, of course, went to the owners of the plantation or what have you. So, but they wanted coffee, so they, of course, had these animals, the civet, around the plantation, and they would find exactly what you think. They would find the droppings of this animal that contained the seeds within the droppings. So basically, out of sheer necessity, because they didn't have anything else available, they cleaned them, of course, and they, you know, processed them into coffee. And the owners of the plantation found out what they were doing, and they tasted it, and it seemed to be better than what was being picked on the plantation. And because they were, of course, rich owners of these plantations, and because you had to find it, it was something that was rare and interesting and different. It, of course, sort of had this now mythic, you know, this coffee's so rare, you have to wait for an animal to shit just to drink it. So it became sort of like a hoity-toity thing to have around that era. So I thought that was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. I've never tasted it myself, but I have heard, you know, from coffee connoisseurs, people who take this seriously, in blind tastings, they are able to distinguish between the Kopi Luwak and non-civet defecated coffee. Right. However, it apparently just does taste like bad coffee, at least according to some of the testers The Specialty Coffee Association of America stated that there is a general consensus within the industry, it just tastes bad.
Right.
And I think there was a professor recently who presented a process by which you could replicate the digestive action of the palm civet on the coffee beans or coffee cherries in the lab. So if that becomes widely adopted, you could get something that is equivalent to Kopi Luwak very cheaply. But I guess then we would see whether the demand is really just because it's rare or because it actually tastes any good.
Well, there's also a novelty factor as well to say, oh, I've had Kopi Luwak.
Yes, I've had the $75 cup of coffee. Mm-hmm.
That came from an animal's butt, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if I had the money, I'd do it just for, you know, just for the sake of it, right?
Yeah.
As this sort of took hold and people wanted to try it and demand went up, you can't simply increase the demand in the wild for these animals to defecate. So, of course, they started to farm it.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly what you think. They're locking these animals in cages and they're force feeding them berries. And of naturally, the quality of the Kopi Luwak is not as good for reasons they seem to cite as the animal itself cannot choose what berries they like and which ones they don't. So they may pick only the best ones to eat themselves, right? And that will, in theory, change the taste of the coffee for better or for worse.
Mm-hmm.
And then the animal itself is not under stress and duress and all and other, you know, malnourishments and what have you. So their system is in a lot better shape to however you want to put it. They themselves are in better shape. Therefore, what they spit out again is in better shape too. So obviously the wild found stuff is the best and the stuff that's farmed is of course, no pun intended, is crap.
There are lots of concerns from animal welfare groups too about how these civets are treated in captivity when they're being force-fed these coffee cherries. Independent investigations have discovered that many of the brands of Kopi Luwak that are marked as, you know, wild harvested are actually from these farms.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Organic.
And, yeah. And there's probably very little oversight into this at all. So, you know, they can probably mark their packages with whatever they like.
Yeah. I would imagine there's not a lot of regulation.
So I'm going to skip the painfully obvious segue and go from talking about Kopi Luwak to talking about coffee enemas. Ian, what's the deal with coffee enemas? Are they the best thing ever? Will they cure what ails you?
Well, according to the woman who calls herself America's Pharmacist Trademark and America's Most Trusted Pharmacist Registered Trademark, Susie Cohen, yes, they are great. According to actual scientific research, no, they are not good. So you take your pick.
I don't know. She's got the trademark.
Yes, I guess America's Pharmacist is now a trademark of Susie Cohen. So this is just obviously one article that I read, sort of comparing and contrasting this same question posed to this Susie Cohen person, who I tried to do a bit of research on myself. I couldn't find a whole lot about her. I mean, I don't know who she is, but it seems to be a sort of the typical TV pharmacist, you know, very much into natural this and that and the other, as recommended by Dr. Oz. So, you know, hey. Anyway, I'm sorry, I need to verge a little bit in the first place. Coffee enema. What? Like, how do you think of that? That's, where did this idea come from? I tried to find that as well. I seem to have found a little bit of research on it. It was started in the 40s, right? The idea of it was first posed as a possible treatment for cancer. What? How does sticking coffee in your ass possibly cure cancer? I'm sorry, it was conceived in 1917.
Oh, man.
Things started in the 20s to try to see what caffeine's effect on the bile duct and small intestines was. So, of course, they wanted to do a more direct link to the bile and the small intestines. So, of course, they put it in your rectum. This Susie Cohen person claims, and I'm going to quote, this is a quote from her. Seriously, coffee enemas may help relieve constipation, insomnia, congenitive problems. They may eliminate or control parasites, candida, which, you know, and other pathogens. Coffee enemas are frequently used in natural cancer protocols. Coffee enemas were outlined in a treatment in the Merck Manual, a thick book that physicians used in their primary reference for decades until the mid-70s.
Oh, it's thick. Well, it must be right then.
Well, yeah, right. The book, the more right it is.
And they used it up until the 70s. So they used it up until the 70s, and then they stopped using it. So, you know, I don't know why they stopped doing that. If it was good enough for the 70s, it's good enough for us, right?
Big pharma, Ian. Big pharma got to them.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. This article that I read here reads very, very childishly, I guess. Sort of nonchalantly about the subject, you know? It doesn't, like, it just, anytime you see something that says, many people agree, or something like that, that coffee enemas are great, you know that it's, of course, pure crap. Because what does that mean? Many people agree. So that means that it's true. A lot of people agree. And it doesn't really cite any, like, you know, Jem Newman, you love citations, don't you?
I do.
Make sure that everything is...
I prefer a citation to an argument in ad populum.
That's right. See, there you go. And this, of course, does none. I won't get into all the other strange things, although, see if I can find it here, as to how many they recommend. I believe it was something to the degree of some people do it 4 times a day.
What? Oh my God.
I prefer to get my coffee 4 times a day.
In your mouth.
Through other orifices.
Okay.
Yes.
The idea of enemas, unless they are medically indicated by a trained and competent health professional, is typically not the best idea to begin with. That's not what your colon needs.
Right.
And it's uncomfortable enough when it's just water or even like an electrolyte mixture going in there. But now we take a nice acidic coffee and we put it in. On really tender tissue.
Yes.
I can imagine that that's nothing but painful.
You could do like a low acidity, I don't know, Guatemalan blend.
Yeah, Jem, no.
Breakfast blend.
Yeah.
Nice dark roast.
So a lot of these ideas came from that original study in 1920. A gentleman named Max Gerson was sort of the head of that, it would appear. He's the person that that seems to be putting out there that sort of the more the merrier. And I'll quote again from this article. At least they say, while the controversial cancer specialist Dr. Max Gerson suggested that up to 6 times per day.
Oh my God.
I think this is way too much for the average person. Doing a coffee enema weekly, even daily for a while, is probably okay. So there you go. 6 times a day in 1920. That's the opinion of Susie Cohen, America's pharmacist trademark. Did you want to know what is the scientific reasoning behind coffee enemas, or what you should do?
Always.
Here's this is the question that was posed to both sides. I see a naturopathic doctor for chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia. She recommended coffee enemas. I'm a faithful reader. Do you think this is safe? No.
Yeah, and this is Scott Gabura of Science Based Medicine, who's a pharmacist who's doing the science based response to this question.
Yes, coffee enemas are considered unsafe and should be avoided. That seems rather obvious to me. Quoting from just from the Wikipedia page, there is no scientific evidence to support any anti-cancer effect of coffee enemas. That again seems painfully obvious. So the idea is that coffee enemas are supposed to be fighting auto-intoxication, the idea that, you know, toxins and poisons and things like that are in your body and you want to get rid of them, right? And of course, there's no link that a coffee enema is going to do such a thing. And aside from the obvious burning of that area, possibly, the idea that you are contaminated with parasites or candida are just that, ideas. It's telling that you have something, and then it's telling you how to treat it. So there you go. So long story short, coffee enemas, not good. And I just watched an episode of Futurama containing coffee enemas. So it goes to show just how far these strange ideas will get.
So why don't we move from talking about coffee to a little bit about tea? Do you guys like tea? Do you drink tea at all?
You know, I'm actually not much of a tea drinker. My mother drinks only teas. And she's a big tea drinker, so considering that, I'm a little surprised that I didn't turn out to be a tea drinker. But I like the occasional cup of a strongly flavored herbal tea and a very occasional cup of a more traditional type of tea, but it's never really my beverage of choice.
I drank it a lot as a kid. Part of my background is English, and a lot of my family does drink tea as opposed to coffee on my mom's side mostly. So we did drink just the standard good old Red Rose with sugar and milk and all that good stuff. Because I guess it was sort of a softened hot beverage that the kids could have, you know, while the adults had coffee or what have you. And I still do enjoy a bit of tea here and there, although I had a green tea because I still wasn't feeling well. I've been ill for the last couple days, so instead of getting coffee this morning, I got green tea, and it is an absolutely poor substitute for coffee, let me tell you. Now, Jem, you fire-haired English bugger, do you drink tea?
I do. I love tea.
I bet you
I am a big fan of both coffee and tea. Now, I probably drink more coffee than I do tea. But a nice Earl Grey, which is black tea with oil of bergamot, which is a citrus fruit, is lovely. I like it loose. But among the bagged tea varieties, Bigelow is my favorite brand of Earl Grey. Very nice. It's an American brand. I prefer tea to coffee in the afternoon, usually, or if I'm sitting down to do some writing. I find it puts me in a sort of a more creative mood. And that's just all psychological, of course. I also have quite the weakness for a traditionally prepared chai masala, which is what I'm drinking right now. I usually actually am drinking tea when we record the podcast.
There you go. The more you know.
So there are lots and lots of different types of teas. You have chai, which is like a black tea that is spiced. Chai masala is the full name of this spiced tea that's popular in India, usually served with milk. Orange pekoe, a lot of people have heard about orange pekoe, which isn't actually a type of tea. It is actually a grade of black tea rather than a specific type. But we've got all sorts of types of tea, like black tea, oolong, green tea, white tea, rooibos, herbal teas. Laura, why don't you tell us more about these specific colors of tea?
Okay, so when we think of tea, most of the world thinks of some variety or another of a beverage that's produced from the plant Camellia sinensis. Whether you drink black tea, green tea, oolong tea, white tea, and this is more than 90% of the tea drunk in the world, all of these different types of tea come from the same tea plant, the Camellia sinensis. And it's basically a shrub, and the tea is from the leaves of the shrub, which are picked. And different leaves have different properties, picking bottom leaves versus top leaves, young leaves versus older leaves, things like that. And different types of leaves are used in different colors and grades of tea. So without getting into it too deeply, because you can really get deeply into this world, the basic differences are that black tea, which is your orange pekoe, your red roses, your tetleys, for those of us in North America here, and just the standard cup of tea in most parts of the world that produces that dark orangish brown color of tea.
Your Tim Hortons steeped tea.
That's your black tea. Right. When you think of just tea, this tends to be the tea that you think of. So this is black tea. And in some parts of Asia, it is called red tea because of the color of the brewed product that gives that dark orange color. But in most parts of the world, it's thought of as black tea because the leaf before brewing is black. So the difference between black tea versus green tea, oolong, and white tea mostly has to do with the level of oxidization. Sometimes oxidation is called fermentation. But this is actually a misnomer in this case. Tea leaves are not typically fermented, but they are oxidized. So basically that means that during part of the processing, after they've been picked and either rolled or cut, the leaves are exposed to a certain amount of humidity and heat. And this will cause oxidation in the leaves. And this is what changes the color of the leaves. So black tea is almost 100% oxidized. And that's why the color of the green leaf changes to black from this heat curing process. Green tea is either not oxidized or only very lightly oxidized. So that's why the leaves remain a green color. like the fresh version. Oolong teas, there are many varieties of oolong teas, and their oxidation level will fall somewhere between green tea and black tea, depending on the variety of oolong that you're drinking. White tea is also made from the same tea plant. It is also lightly oxidized, probably in the range of green tea, somewhere between a light oolong and a green tea. The difference between the white tea and the other three is that this tea uses some of the leaves, typically the top leaves, but also the buds of the tea plant. The black, the green, and the oolong do not use the buds. And the term white tea comes from the fine silver white hairs on the buds of the tea plant.
Interesting.
The tea itself is actually a light yellow color, similar to a green tea, maybe even a little bit lighter. So that's the basics of the teas. Now, there are many different varieties of each of these teas, particularly in China and Japan, where tea growing is very much an art form, it seems. There are very specific regional strains. It's almost an artisanal practice, especially with the oolong teas. So I'm not going to get into it, but just to know that black tea can come in many different varieties, same with green, oolong, and even white tea. Now, all of these teas do contain caffeine because the Camellia sinensis plant does naturally produce caffeine. The amount of caffeine varies depending on the type of tea that you're drinking. So black tea has the most caffeine, green tea tends to have the least, but all of the types of tea from this plant do have caffeine in them. There's also several beverages that are commonly referred to as tea that are not actually from the tea plant. So one of the first ones is rooibos tea, which is traditionally grown in South Africa. It's made from the leaves of a low ground-dwelling plant, and it's often called red tea. This is a relatively new addition to the North American market. I think it's been around for about 10 to 20 years or so, but it's been consumed for many, many, many years in South Africa. This tea does not contain any caffeine because that plant does not produce it. You also have herbal teas, and there are hundreds of varieties of this. These are not actually teas. They're more so infusions is what we'll call them, steeped infusions. And they're based on dried fruits, fruit rinds, spices, herbs, all sorts of other things. They're typically caffeine-free because most of the ingredients do not contain caffeine. Most fruits and stuff do not contain it. And unless these herbal infusions are blended with leaves from the tea plant, they will remain caffeine-free. Another type of tea that is starting to become popular here in North America is yerba mate, or as I learned it, erva mate. Have either of you guys heard of this?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, I have.
So I learned about this because I spent 3 months in Brazil almost 10 years ago. And I was in the southern part of Brazil where this erva mate or yerba mate is grown. And it is drunk for many people as the primary beverage throughout the day. So what it is it's basically an herbal infusion from the leaves of the Ilex paraguarensis plant. Basically, it's a shrub, but it can actually grow to tree size, and it's a plant that's a member of the holly family. Plants are grown, the leaves are picked, dried, and ground up, and some of the stems are actually ground in as well, very fine stems. And then this is mixed with hot water. Actually, hot water is poured over it to steep and then drunk. Even though it's not from the tea plant from Asia, it does contain caffeine naturally. Sometimes, though, the caffeine in the yerba mate is referred to as matine or matine. That's more of a linguistic difference. Chemically, they're exactly the same. So some of the claims around yerba mate are that, oh, it's caffeine-free and matein is better for you or something. Matein is caffeine.
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen lots of natural health purveyors talk about how matein is superior to coffee because it is caffeine-free and it stimulates the immune system, not the nervous system, and a lot of made-up stuff.
Just an anecdote. I was working at a restaurant and a little sort of coffee shop type place, and the big announcement came through that we were going to get yerba mate. It's this new thing, and all the people are drinking it and what have you. And we actually had to have a dude come in and, like, teach us about it. I remember we had to stay after this place had closed and, like, have this dude give this weird presentation about this stuff. Anyway, the point is that he said exactly what you just said, Jim, which was, well, man, it's, you know, and yes, he did talk like that a little bit. I'm only slightly exaggerating. It's all natural, man, and it's, you know, it's the matine. It's not like caffeine. And I later learned that they call it matine because it's yerba mate. Is that true?
Yes, exactly.
Even though it's matine, man. It's not caffeine. It's different. No, it's the exact same thing, but you put an M instead of a C. So, you know, you're not fooling anybody there, Mr. Hippie. But anyway, yes, to your point, Jem, it was exactly what you just said. They told us, and we were supposed to tell our customers, oh, you know, try this. It's better for you. It doesn't... Nah, nah, nah. Yeah, it's a little misleading, to say the least.
Right. That's actually a really great point, Ian. In North America, at least, it is very, the mate is very heavily marketed as having numerous health benefits to all kinds of body systems. In the areas where it has been traditionally consumed, like Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, Uruguay, it's commonly believed to be a fairly healthy thing. But at least when I was there, the degree to which people are willing to believe that it cures this and that is much, much lower than it is here.
I guess it would be sort of like somebody here claiming that coffee would cure this, that, or the other.
Right, right. The interesting thing about yerba mate is that it's very much a social event to drink it and a communal thing. So unlike most cups of tea and coffee, where each drinker will get their own cup to steep their own leaves or their own cup of brewed coffee and add whatever they like to it, yerba mate is typically served in a communal cup, which is frequently a gourd that's been hollowed out and dried. And it is drunk through a metal straw called a bomba that has a strainer on the end so that the little particles of tea don't get into the straw. And this is passed around to everyone in a group. So it's very much a thing that everyone does together. Many people will drink the mate on their own just because they enjoy it. But it's very much a communal social event to drink it. So that's one thing that's very interesting, because in South America, you would never see mate served in a tea bag, or very rarely. It is there, but that's not how people drink it for the most part. Whereas here in North America, that's frequently how it's being marketed. It's not being marketed as the social communal aspect. One thing that I will note, in the Brazil where I was, the people that I was with were all very big fans of the yerba mate, and they do note that a lot of them don't sleep a lot, and part of that is because they're drinking mate all day long. So they do know that it's high in caffeine, and they're pretty aware that it has an effect on sleep patterns.
So where do these people, by these people, I mean this hippie dude that came into this restaurant I was working at, like, are they misinformed? They, the distributor of this product, have they been misinformed in the first place? Or do they know outright that they are just completely lying out of their ass? Like, I don't understand.
I think a lot of people don't really think about it that way. That's not necessarily a true dichotomy. You know, they just believe what they're told, and they don't bother to investigate it themselves. You know, they aren't practiced in critical thinking, and so they, you know, if there's a website that's telling them these things, they won't try to double check with a hostile source and see if there's a controversy about it. Some of it may be a miscommunication. You know, the term caffeine, you know, has its root in cafe or coffee, just like matéine has its root in mate. So there may be people who legitimately are saying, well, you know, we'll call it this because it's naturally occurring. You know, it's not like it's extracted from coffee. So, you know, there could be some miscommunications going on. It could be people just not double checking. But I think for a lot of people, it will sell the beverage better if people think it's caffeine free, but they still get the kick out of it. So I think you'll get your usual combination of people cynically taking advantage of others and people just not bothering to check their sources.
Yeah, I suppose it's one of those things where, you know, it's not necessarily a lie. It's sort of just a half-truth or a bending of the truth. So
right.
But it's the same chemical. Like, yeah, it does contain caffeine.
Right, yeah.
Like, to a degree, I think that if these people are selling this product, whether they know that they're wrong about it containing caffeine or not, I think is irrelevant. You know, whether they're ignorant of the facts or whether they're actively lying, it amounts to the same thing. Because when you're selling a product, you have a responsibility to be truthful in the way you're advertising it and selling it, I think. And
yeah,
if
good point.
Through your own negligence you mislead others, then that's just as bad.
Right.
That's fair.
Going back a little bit, I think too that the people who sell this, at least who bring these types of products to North America, to new markets, typically they tend to be looking for traditional, see my air quotes here, remedies, right? They tend to be in the market for those things. And mate, for example, is a traditional remedy in that it's been used for many, many, many years, hundreds of years even, by the indigenous peoples of those regions of South America. And so there's that fallacy out there that, well, if it's been used for thousands of years, it must be effective. It must be good.
Right, yeah.
And so then I think, as Jem was saying, that these marketers and importers and that are not well-trained in critical thinking and perhaps are looking for particular types of products and effects. And when they ask people who have been traditionally using it why they use this product, those people will probably give traditional uses. But just because there is a traditional use that's saying, oh, well, we always use this for this reason because it makes us feel happy or something like that, whatever the reason is, it doesn't mean that it is actually effective for that.
Right.
But given that there's no critical thinking, those traditional uses and whatever else the marketer can think of get slapped on the label and sold as such.
Right. Using the Amazon for 300 years.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
It sounds real important when you say, you know, oh, well, then obviously it's good. I must be missing out.
Okay, so let's talk about the relative caffeine content in various types of things that you might be consuming. So this is all fairly complicated because there are differences in serving sizes, growing conditions, roasting and oxidating procedures, and even just dumb luck. All of these things can have a huge impact on the caffeine content of a beverage, but let's give this a go. Well, the serving size that we talk about when we talk about a cup of coffee can actually vary wildly. So I had to do some mathematical adjustments to some of these numbers to bring things into line with serving sizes that you, our dear listener, might encounter. When you see the nutrition facts about a cup of coffee, usually that means somewhere between 5 and 7 ounces, but that's far less than people typically consume in an actual serving of coffee. I have a range of numbers for coffee and tea, but for things that are artificially caffeinated, like cola, the numbers are much more precise. And finally, I'm going to be mixing metric and imperial measurements here just based on what measurement unit is most commonly used here in Canada. We still have some imperial holdovers. But if you want to convert, just remember that there are 8 ounces in about 237 milliliters, though usually we just round that up to 250. So 8 ounces equals 250 milliliters. And the numbers that Tim Hortons lists on their website for caffeine content are actually less than those numbers I list here. I don't know if that's because their coffee actually contains less caffeine than the coffee that was used to generate these numbers, or if their estimates are different for some other reason. Caveats out of the way. In descending order of caffeination per serving, we have, at the top, what I had for breakfast this morning. A 24-ounce cup of coffee. This is 710 milliliters of coffee. A Tim Hortons extra large with somewhere between 394 and 600 milligrams of caffeine. Next, we have a 20-ounce cup of coffee, a Tim Hortons large or a Starbucks venti with between 329 and 500 milligrams. Next, we have the 14-ounce cup of coffee, a Tim Hortons medium, with between 230 and 350 milligrams. Then you have a double espresso, which is about 200 milligrams of caffeine. And an extra strength caffeine tablet is also 200 milligrams typically. an 8-ounce cup of coffee, which is one cup, or a Tim Hortons extra small, contains 131 to 200 milligrams. A single espresso shot has about 100 milligrams of caffeine, as does a regular strength caffeine tablet. Next, we have a cup of herbal mate, prepared with 6 grams of mate powder that will have about 85 milligrams of caffeine, although that will vary greatly depending on your concentration of mate that you put in there. A 250 milliliter can of Red Bull is 80 milligrams. Then a 355 milliliter can of Mountain Dew, either Canadian or American, will contain 54 milligrams. An 8-ounce cup of Stash Earl Grey black tea, steeped for 3 minutes, has 48 milligrams. An 8-ounce cup of Exotica China white tea has 37 milligrams. An 8-ounce cup of Stash Darjeeling black has 36 milligrams. A can of Coca-Cola, 355 milliliters, has 34 milligrams of caffeine. Mm. An 8-ounce cup of Stash Premium green tea has 29 milligrams of caffeine. A bar of Hershey's milk chocolate has 10 milligrams. And finally, any amount of herbal tea or tisane has 0 milligrams-ish. Mm. These numbers and several others that I've left out, as well as additional details, will be available in the show notes at winnipegskeptics.com/blog or lueepodcast.wordpress.com. So I think it's interesting to note that while some tea enthusiasts, including me, have tried to rank different types or colors of tea in terms of caffeine content, with the idea being that the caffeine content will vary based on the oxidation and preparation process, which it does, the reality is that the growing conditions and the way the tea is processed, which will vary greatly between regions and between companies, and just the amount of time that you steep the tea for, has a much bigger impact on the caffeine content than whether the tea is labeled black, white, or green. So while Laura's right when she says that black teas tend to have the most caffeine and green teas tend to have the least, when you compare between brands and between regions, the variation between colors of tea is subsumed within the variation between brands. And a 2008 study in the Journal of Analytical Toxicology, which we'll link to in the show notes, of course, found, quote, no observable trend in caffeine concentration due to the variety of tea, end quote. So here are some sort of fun comparisons. An extra large coffee from Tim Hortons should have about as much caffeine as 4 to 6 shots of espresso, or 2 to 3 extra-strength caffeine tablets.
Wow.
An entire bar of Hershey's milk chocolate only contains about 5 to 8% as much caffeine as an extra-small cup of coffee. It may surprise you to learn that a can of Coke contains only 10 to 15% of the caffeine as the same amount of coffee, which would be a Starbucks tall, while a can of Red Bull, which is smaller, contains 40 to 60% as much caffeine as the same amount of coffee. So maybe it gives you wings, but a Tim Hortons extra small would give you even more wings.
An extra large is what you had this morning.
Yes.
What kind of wings does that give you? Is it up to 600? Is that what you said?
This was all based on 7-ounce cups of coffee, which I then multiplied out to be the appropriate sizes. So according to that, a Tim Hortons extra large should have between 400 and 600 milligrams of caffeine.
Wow.
Which is, Red Bull was 80 milligrams of caffeine.
Yeah.
Now, as I said earlier, Tim Hortons, when they list their caffeine content, they have their caffeine content significantly lower than these numbers. So I don't know if their numbers are idealized or if it has to do with the strength of the brew or the specific roast that they're using, but that's for an equivalently large cup of coffee.
Red Bull gives you wings.
A lot of caffeine.
Tim Hortons gives you a rapid heartbeat.
Yes. Tim Hortons gives you a jetpack.
Yes.
So dark roast coffee generally has a little less caffeine than light roast coffee because the roasting process reduces the caffeine content in the beans by a small amount, but that will also depend whether you're measuring by weight or by volume, because the density of the coffee changes the more you roast it. Arabica coffee, which makes up the vast majority of coffee consumed in North America, typically contains slightly less caffeine than Robusta coffee, which is more commonly used in darker, more flavorful Italian espresso blends. And percolated coffee contains a little less caffeine than drip coffee. The numbers that I presented earlier were for drip coffee. And finally, decaffeinated coffee still contains usually between 3 and 13% of the caffeine as a fully caffeinated cup of coffee.
Hmm.
What?
Yeah.
So
yeah, decaffeinated coffee, it removes a lot of the caffeine, but by no means all of the caffeine. You could not call decaffeinated coffee caffeine-free.
Who knew? How would you? There you go.
Let's talk about health a little bit more, and then we'll wrap things up. So various bogus health claims related to coffee and tea. Often these claims are only implied via sly, that is to say, dishonest advertising. I love David's Tea, for example. They've got some lovely loose teas, but if I pay too much attention when I'm in the store, I can work myself into quite a frothing fit pretty easily, as my lovely wife can attest. If you walk past a David's Tea, you can see them just barely skirting around the edge of making actionable health claims, and occasionally maybe darting over the line in their advertising. So I'll present some claims, actually not from David's Tea, because their claims are harder to find on the internet. Maybe they're covering their ass in that way. But I'll present some claims from that bastion of science-based reality, the Daily Mail, who asked a homeopath to comment on the healthfulness of various herbal teas. Hey guys, what do you think elderflower tea cures?
I'm sorry, what? You're asking me?
Yes, Ian.
I don't even know what that is, I'm sorry. What is elderflower?
It's a flower. It's an old flower.
Yeah, Gandalf. Gandalf drinks that, right?
So elderflower tea is thought to cure the common cold. And when I say thought to cure the common cold, I mean by this particular homeopath. She thinks it cures the common cold. It does not.
Right.
ginger tea is apparently an excellent remedy in the early stages of an infection because, as a warming spice, it can promote a fever and thus hasten healing. I'm not making this up.
Wow.
The homeopath is.
Right.
Japanese green tea apparently strengthens tissue cells found all over the body, so it protects the body from aging.
Mm.
Wonderfully scientific and specific, green tea strengthens tissue cells. I'll also note that green tea is not in any way a herbal tea. It's an actual tea, right?
Now, green tea gets a lot of attention for all of its health-promoting benefits that you were just sort of alluding to there. Longevity, fighting cancer, weight loss, just general health and well-being. When we look at populations that drink a lot of green tea, a lot of lay people will say, oh, well, it's the green tea that makes them healthy, and they drink green tea instead of coffee, instead of whatever else. And that's what makes their cancer risk lower or makes them live longer and that. But you have to look very carefully at the population and at the lifestyle and environment in which that population lives as well. Typically, populations that drink a lot of green tea live very different lifestyles than your typical North American lifestyle and diet. So to say that it's just the green tea, which I've heard many people tell me that, oh, when they switched to green tea, they got healthier and this and that and the other. That would be not a fair assumption.
Sure. So this homeopath goes on to claim that herbal teas with fennel are apparently good for controlling flatulence because, and I quote, the herb has antispasmodic properties. This means it works on relaxing the intestinal muscles, end quote. Because flatulence is apparently the result of muscle spasms and not, say, a byproduct of digestion.
Awesome.
And finally, this homeopath claims that tea with St. John's wort is an antidepressant because, and again I quote, research shows that St. John's wort helps with depression by raising chemical levels in the brain. Yep. Raises chemical levels in the brain.
All of
That's
them.
Some solid the science you've got there, Daily Mail.
It raises all
Those
of them.
Chemicals.
Who needs doctors or dietitians when you've got a homeopath on speed dial? Now, there has been some research to suggest that St. John's wort can serve as an antidepressant to some degree, but its clinical significance has been widely questioned in the medical literature, and it is certainly not a slam dunk. So it should go without saying that none of these claims have really held up in the scientific literature, and they often fail both the tests of statistical and clinical significance, as well as some basic plausibility.
I don't know if I told you this. Mallory and I went to the CAA to, I think we were getting like our international driver's licenses or something, and on the counter they had a guaranteed jet lag cure.
Oh yeah.
Oh yes.
I should have picked it up and kind of looked at it and to see what it was. And I thought to myself, how the hell do you, how does that even work? What is the mechanism that can somehow fix your body into thinking that it's in a different time zone? And then I read on the packaging, homeopathic. So not only, I mean, I don't know what possible chemical or herbal or what have you, compound you could come up with that could just make your body go onto the proper schedule. Like, I don't really know what, how you would even do that. And then you add on top of that, of course, that it is now homeopathic, which means that whatever it is, whatever does do that, there's no active ingredient within that
yeah,
pill.
There's none of it in there.
Yeah, whatever it is, it ain't there. I just thought that was very just weird. Like, come on.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my two cents.
So there are plenty of health claims related to caffeinated coffees and teas as well. It's not limited to herbal stuff. Some bogus, some not. I mean, according to every newspaper article ever printed on the subject of hot beverages, they're either the healthiest substances or the most dangerous drinks on the planet. So let's close out the show with a really brief overview of what is probably true and what is probably not when it comes to caffeinated beverages. So caffeine certainly isn't inert. It can exacerbate some health problems, such as gastroesophageal reflux, which is something that I suffer from. It's also been associated with a slightly decreased risk of certain cancers, hepatocellular, endometrial, and colorectal cancers. But it has also been associated with a slightly increased risk of other cancers, bladder cancer, for example. Recent research has shown that consumption of caffeine, even in significant amounts, does not have a large impact on your risk for hypertension. It may have a protective effect with regard to cirrhosis of the liver and adult onset diabetes. And caffeine has also been shown to increase wakefulness, and aid in memory and concentration. So it is certainly a psychoactive substance. The evidence regarding caffeine in pregnancy, you know, you may have heard don't drink caffeine while pregnant. That has been mixed, with some studies showing an increased risk of miscarriage or congenital malformations to a small degree, while other studies find no link even when moderate to high doses of caffeine are consumed. However, these studies are generally of low quality for several reasons, including the ethical concern over randomizing pregnant women to either take caffeine or not take caffeine when there is some concern over its safety. However, most obstetrics associations these days, including the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and food safety agencies, including the UK Food Standards Agency, they all recommend that pregnant women consume no more than 200 milligrams of caffeine per day, which is about two servings of coffee-ish. And according to journalist Murray Carpenter, who did a deep dive on the subject for his 2014 book Caffeinated, quote, "The simple answer is, if you're not pregnant or expecting or hoping to become pregnant, and you don't have trouble with insomnia or anxiety, and you're happy with your caffeine use, I've seen nothing to indicate that it's going to shorten your life or make you less healthy. And of course, there are some things that suggest specifically that caffeinated coffee may even have some beneficial health effects." End quote. So, drink up. That's coffee, that's tea, and that's caffeine more generally.
Yay.
All right.
Anyway, thanks for joining me, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Life, the Universe, and Everything Else. If you have any questions or comments, or you'd like to suggest a topic for the show, send us an email at lueepodcast@winnipegskeptics.com. If you want to show your support, you can leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher, follow us on Twitter or Facebook, or just share the show with a friend. Our music is produced by the very talented Ian James, and this episode was edited by Jem Newman. Ian, I was wondering, did you ever see that that old Sega Game Gear commercial where it was like there's a flight attendant on a plane? You remember that?
That does sound really familiar, but I don't recall 100%.
I'll send you a link. It is
Sega.
Sega. By Fethrin I should have practiced this first. Imidalcloprid, acetaminoprid, chlorof...
Adamantium.
I'm just going to skip that.
It's a good thing we weren't in the same room, Jem, because I might have smacked you.
I'm going to remove my hoodie.
I guess we'll allow it, Ian. But stop at the hoodie.
Speaking of coffee, I've had the flu, so I haven't had a cup of coffee in about 5 days. Me, no likey.
She seems to be like the Fraser Crane of pharmacists.
And naturally, this guy was this horrible-smelling, scruffy, bearded dude. No offense, Jem.
I'm waiting for a description that doesn't fit me.
Right. He was handsome and... Sorry. I made a stupid-ass joke and I ruined everything.
Coffee? Tea?
Back up!